welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Although quite a few inches shorter than I am, Richard Smith was one of the few people I've interviewed who've walked faster than I do. I had to stop a couple of times while recording the interview just to catch my breath. Not only a fast walker, Richard is someone who packs a lot into one life. A gynecology cancer consultant and surgeon, womb transplant specialist, academic author, and father of four. However, it is his enthusiasm for walking long distances, chanting while walking, and discovering pilgrimage sites that has drawn me to him. I was introduced to him by one of his neighbours, fellow Scot Tim Ingram-Smith, whom I've also interviewed, and who invited me to the book launch of another of Richard's books, The Journey, Spirituality, Pilgrimage, Chant. Richard accompanies me on a short walk along the Regent's Canal, and within the breadth of our conversation we discuss the value to him of walking, of chant, and walking in silence, as well as the benefits that walking can bring to women as they grow older, whether cancer sufferers or not. I was looking at the book, and I saw there was a photograph of you leaning on your poles. So when you go for long walks, you're a pole user, are you?
Yeah, very much so.
And why is that?
Oh, I think it makes you go faster.
Well, hang on a moment. The listeners don't know this, but I'm trying to slow you down because you're already rocketing along.
Yeah, well, I go much faster if I've got my poles. I love my alpine poles because they're very old-fashioned. They've got no cork to protect your hands, so you do sometimes get a bit of a kind of Raynaud's thing where your fingers go numb. There's no absorption in them. But for wild dogs, particularly in Greece, they're a sensation because all dogs are frightened of long poles with spikes on them. And in Greece, quite a few of the places I've walked, there's signs up saying beware of wild dogs. And so they're a handy accompaniment there as well. So yeah, I love my poles, I have to say.
Let's explore a bit more. Why do you do a lot of walking in Greece?
Oh, lots of remote areas. It reminds me quite a lot of Scotland, but the weather is universally better. I love the people. Yeah, I'm a huge Hellenophile. I first went there age 17, but at that age I wasn't a big walker at all. But these days, most of the trips to Greece involve some fairly hard walking, except we have a summer holiday there, which is not quite the same. The topography of the country, high mountains, beautiful sea, because I like swimming as well, outdoor swimming. And so I've usually got my swimming costume on my back. Now, I'm the same in Scotland, but it's definitely the Aegean and the Ionian seas are a bit more appealing than
Have you been a sort of all-action adventure from a childhood, from a young boy, where you're out walking and swimming and Munro bagging from an early age?
No, not at all, interestingly. I got into all of this actually in my kind of mid to late 30s. I got into outdoor swimming in my early 30s, and long-distance walking came late 30s, really, actually, courtesy of my wife, because she was the one who was the bigger walker when we first met than I was.
Mm-hmm. And the walking is not just to see the scenery. You do this, actually, because in your book, which is... it's called The Journey.
Yes.
Yeah. You are making a journey yourself in your own mind. But many of these walks are part of some kind of pilgrimage.
They're part of pilgrimage. Many of them, exactly. Even short walks, actually, in the English countryside. They're also accompanied by, and this we get into the slightly more obscure, but chant. And chant can be either secular or non-secular. And it's repetitive, it's the repetition of a prayer. If you're a Christian tradition, it could be a mantra in some of the Eastern traditions. And once you get in the vein of this, you can walk at high speed.
Isn't that something the military taught us?
What happens with the chant is that in your head, you actually end up in your chest, and you are breathing. The first half of the chant you're breathing in, the second half you're breathing out. And the chant, the words, are in time to your heart rate. So, of course, if you're walking fast, you get your heart rate pushed up to probably about 120 beats per minute. And that's the speed that you're I was going to say saying the chant, but it's not really quite true, because when you get good at the chant, you don't actually need to say it aloud. You're saying it in your head.
Yeah.
And so my first introduction to Christian chant was through a book called The Way of a Pilgrim, which was possibly written by Tolstoy. It's an unknown authorship, Russian book. And the pilgrim, well, is ostensibly seeking Jerusalem, although he actually never gets to Jerusalem. But he learns the trick of unceasing prayer, which is chant. And he describes in the book that when he's walking 20 miles a day, if he's tired, he does the chant and all tiredness goes away.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
exactly what happens. If you do the chant, tiredness disappears and you're walking along in a very almost ecstatic way, actually.
Can we equate this to something like the philosopher's walk and the repetitive walk?
Yes.
The repetitive nature of something. Doing something repetitive allows consciousness to disengage, maybe.
I would absolutely go with that.
Yeah, there's something yeah. there, isn't it?
Is there
the physical motion, because we put left, right, leg
yes,
movement.
Absolutely.
I mean, I read somewhere that you actually only speed up when walking by lengthening the length of your stride, because your legs are like a metronome. They do 2 steps a second.
Okay.
So there's the chant, but also something I read in the book, remind me if I got this wrong, but you're quite into hypnotherapy.
It's quite interesting, because I have practiced hypnotherapy as a physician since I was originally in my mid-20s. And for many years I did actually run a hypnotherapy clinic. And then when I became a consultant, which was in my early 30s, I had no longer got the time to run a hypnosis clinic. So the only people I've hypnotised since then are myself, and I do that regularly, and 2 of my 4 children. 2 of my children are very cynical and not hypnotisable, but the other 2 will go into a deep trance. But funnily enough, I was standing after one of our group meetings for the practice, and we've got a number of complementary therapists as well as other physicians, and there's a fellow, Tony Yardley-Jones, who has a device which measures, or teaches you, I should say, secular chant. And he was listening to our hypnotherapist, Sean Hammond, and myself talking. And Sean and I both do chant, and we both self-hypnotise. And we were both agreeing that hypnotic trance is not the same as the place you get in your head with chant. There's some similarities, but they're not quite the same.
I'm being too clever here and trying to say that artists or dancers who get into the flow, or philosophers who get into being, it's not quite the same thing.
Well, I know you're expanding. This is very interesting.
Yeah, I'm sweeping it all in here.
No, well, there's the Sufis as well.
Yeah, of
and
course.
And the whirling dervishes and all that whirling dance, which is done, and they are definitely in an ecstatic state. There you've definitely, to my mind, got a mixture of hypnotic trance and chant. If you look at chant, that's a measurable thing with a device which looks at cardiac beat-to-beat variability. And if you're anxious and angry or feeling tetchy, your beat-to-beat variability, if you look at the graph, looks like a spiky line. But if you get the Mozart Bach moment, mm-hmm. then you get a beautiful sinusoidal pattern. And certainly Yardley-Jones put me on his machine, and I chanted and rapidly arrived at the sinusoidal pattern.
I'm sort of gathering everything up and exploring whether flow, repetitive walking, being, you say you've mentioned the Sufis and things like that. So when you're yourself out walking in the mountains, sometimes you walk alone, sometimes you walk with a companion.
Yeah.
I mean, who's your companion? It's not your wife. You're not walking with your wife.
No, I do sometimes walk with my wife, and also with my family. Sometimes walk with my son, my daughters. For the longer distance walks, where we've been really kind of going for it, so the 20 to 25 miles a day over 3-4 days, then my walking companion has been Andrew Wakeham Dawson, who is a remarkable guy. He's a chaplain in the RAF these days, but he is also the editor-in-chief of the World Journal of Insectology. And there's a beautiful piece of synchronicity. I'm a gynecological cancer surgeon. Andrew is actually the world expert on butterflies' genitalia, which is quite an unusual thing to be the world expert on, but that is what he is.
You're a consultant, a surgeon.
Yes.
You must have periods where you have to focus intensely on what you're doing.
Absolutely, for hours at a time.
I mean, is there some parallel between, you know, walking and for long distances, a sort of getting into a trance-like state? Is that something that you set yourself in motion before you go into the theatre?
I mean, no, not beforehand, but when you're in the theatre, you do get into what I would call the tunnel, which is that everything else that's going on is excluded. Now, for me, that process is massively assisted by listening to Baroque classical music, and massively hindered, interestingly, by listening to rock music. I can't bear rock music in theatre. But Baroque music, and then you get in the zone where you're totally concentrating. But in the process of that, in your head, it's quite interesting, you quite often wander off, and I'm all sorts of... Your brain's working in a sort of parallel. Yeah. So you're concentrating on what you're doing, but actually as well, quite often I'm drawn to walks, particularly, I suppose, around the south end of Bute, interestingly, and out in the Chiltern Hills, which are not huge walks, they're kind of 8-10 mile walks. Certainly in the Chilterns, there's lots of lovely old English country churches, which all of which are open, which is lovely. Because that's, if I've got one minor complaint about Greece, except on the island of Patmos, where everything is open, and on Mount Athos, where everything is open, but in the rest of Greece, most of the churches, sadly, are locked. But I know that's because they're only used maybe once or twice a year, whereas English churches are used every week mostly. So I don't know if that's strictly answered your question, but I don't prepare...
By going for a walk?
By going for a walk,
no. But what I was actually saying was, is there any parallel between the fact that you're obviously part of a massive team in the
Absolutely,
theater.
Absolutely.
But in preparation or in the work that you're doing, you are the surgeon.
Correct.
So I was just trying to see whether there was something about the sort of independence of thought or the independence of responsibility was something that you saw when you went for a walk as a kind of pilgrimage.
It's interesting because the pilgrimage aspect, there's a Celtic concept of thin places.
Yeah, no, I was going to come to that, so better come to it now.
Where one feels closer to one's God.
Yeah.
And I have to say that the places which I love walking are all, to me, thin places. I don't want you to think I'm a bit kooky here, but there was a friend who started talking to me about those old ley lines that are across England and Scotland.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of the walks that I enjoy in England are on those old ley lines. So there's an area of Cornwall that we walk, there's an area in the Chilterns, there's an area in Berkshire, and actually it's all along one line, which I had no knowledge of until about a year ago. And I don't have any understanding of the concept, I have to say. But I do know that deep inside, it's like the icing on the cake. So you have good quality exercise, fast walking, in beautiful countryside, whilst you're chanting. And then just for good measure, you're doing it in a thin place. You've got the full Monty then.
Yeah. No, because I was going to ask you about these thin places, because I thought that was a really lovely concept. And they don't have to be in thin air.
No, absolutely.
They don't have to be up a mountain.
Well, the funniest thing is that the two thinnest places to me have been Iona and Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, of course, is actually a very crowded city with a whole load of stuff going down there. But it's, to me, that's a very unusual thing, is to find the thin places in the middle of a bustling city. Iona, Mount Athos, and then... I know we talk about in the book, Wakeham Dawson and I went from Spoleto, where St. Francis had his conversion experience, across the hills, and the last hill was Monte Sabazio, which is above Assisi. And then you come down into Assisi, and the St. Francis Hermitage Cave Monastery, which is high on the hill above Assisi. In there is something which is like a cave, that's where the thought came from in my mind, which was St. Francis's bedroom, which is a tiny stone room with a stone bed and a stone pillow and a huge window with no glass in it, with a kind of 200 foot drop. If St. Francis had done any sleepwalking, it would have been a one-way ticket, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And there, to me on the Monte Sabazio and then down that hillside to the Hermitage of St. Francis was the thinnest place of that walk, rather than, dare I say it, in Assisi itself, which is very, very beautiful. It's funny because when we walked into Assisi, you know, you've got that look, if you've done a long distance walk, you've got compasses hanging off your rucksack and you look dusty. And there was a fellow sitting in a bar at the top of the town, and he was the only walker we saw the entire trip, and he was tucking into a large cold beer, and he raised his glass and just said, "Good Camino." And he'd spotted two fellow walkers with sore feet, but looking very happy with themselves.
Okay, the patience you have,
yeah,
and the work that you're doing, it's life and death stuff, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you do talk about how important you feel people's spiritual strength,
yes,
and psychological, and as well as physical
agreed,
are important in whether they overcome the disease or whether they succumb.
Yes.
There's a lot of sort of like charity walks for cancer.
Yes, there are. Breast cancer research do a lot of that stuff.
Is walking something that is encouraged, and would you be encouraging people recovering from cancer to try that?
Yeah, very. In fact, I'm encouraging all of my patients to walk. Now, remember, I'm a gynecological cancer surgeon, so all my patients are women. And women have this terrible problem, which is when they've gone through the menopause, they will lose 50% of their bone mineral density within 20 years of that menopause. And unfortunately, many of our cancer patients are young and they go through an early menopause. If they walk, and it's the golden rule is 10,000 steps three times a week as an absolute minimum, then they will maintain their bone mineral density. So the average woman will go through the menopause age 50. By 70, she's lost 50% of her bone mass, and that's the point where she's vulnerable to fractured neck of femur, collapse of vertebrae, and the classic Coley's fracture, old lady falls forward and breaks her wrist. Certainly the back and the hip fractures are preventable by decent levels of walking. And so I'm a huge proponent of getting people to buy pedometers and get out there walking. And in fact, we're about to start running some courses where we take people out in the country, long distance walking, and get them going with poles and start teaching them how to breathe right so that they can build up a big pace.
A bit like Nordic walking.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
For me, the big message of the book, and it's been the big revelation for me in my own life, which is to get out there, get walking, learn how to chant, and then select good places to do that walking, and you find something which is truly magical.
When you say good places to walk, that's a bit subjective.
Oh, very, very.
I'm going to explore what you mean by what.
Okay, so it's a very, very good point. So in the UK, as a group, and a big group, we did the Canterbury Walk for my 50th birthday, when we walked from Rochester to Canterbury along the Chaucerian route.
And that's about 35, 40 miles.
It was actually a wee bit more. It was 15, no, you're right, it was 15 the first day and 24 the second. So it was a big walk on just over 2 days. We promptly, as a group, it wasn't a particularly spiritual walk, it was fantastic fun, but we quite rapidly became quite Chaucerian. We all got into a nin on the first night and started drinking very heavily and generally in massive party mode.
I was going to say, how Chaucerian were you going to be? You're already talking Middle English, were you?
It was lacking, dare I say it, in spirituality. Not when we got to Canterbury, but the actual walk was jolly and it was great fun.
Yeah.
And then we did the St Andrew's Walk, which was the walk where Scottish pilgrims in the Middle Ages used to cross from South Queen's Ferry near Edinburgh to North Queen's Ferry, which is the site of the current fourth bridges. It's almost three now, railway and two road bridges. And then the pilgrims used to walk along the Fife coast, and we did that walk.
Wow.
For which I got quite a lot of stick, because I told the family, this was a family walk with my sister, who's another big long-distance walker. I said that it was coastal, therefore flat. But actually, if you look over at Fife Coast, it goes up and down.
No, it's not that flat.
And it's not flat at all. And it transpired we'd done thousands of feet of climb and drop in the course of doing the route. That's another great route. And I think there, the same as Canterbury, the walk is so steeped in history and all the people who've done it. And if your eyes are open, you see the signs of it. So I think it was in Crail or Pittenweem. There's a house which one gable end has been set with seashells. And of course there are scallop shells, the traditional sign of the Santiago pilgrimage, St. James's pilgrimage walk. There's scallop shells set in the walls. And once you've got into a bit of knowledge about all of this stuff, you start to see all those signs that this is where the medieval pilgrims were. Quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, those are your two recommended walks, really.
Well, for UK...
For long distance,
I would strongly recommend those two walks. If you're looking for what I would call a one-day pilgrimage through small English country churches, then, you know, the Chiltern Hills out north of London, it's only an hour's drive away, and you can walk for hours.
You can take the Metropolitan line.
Yes, you can. Yeah. And you can walk for hours.
And never from Maribyrn, yeah.
And never see a soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And really just sink into a completely different place than the freneticism of London. And for me, you know, I very much enjoy my job, but it's pretty all-encompassing when you're doing it. And
yeah,
finding methods to switch off. I'm lucky because I don't do any intensive on-call, but I do 11 hours a day, 5 days a week, with no breaks. I mean, there's no lunch break or anything like that. You just eat a sandwich on the hoof. So getting out into the countryside and walking is seriously restorative.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Richard Smith. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Saunders of Easytronic.